The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Good morning, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt, and I'm here to tell you I love this column in The Telegraph. Now, when I do my show prep, I do it this way. I start with the Times of Israel, and I don't understand what's going on in Israeli politics again. Michael Oren is coming up. Then I go to the Financial Times. It's in Great Britain, and The Telegraph. So those are my three international papers. Then I come to the United States and do the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, and the Washington Post. Then I just cruise around. And I get most of my stories from that, and I do it late at night, so it's ready for me in the morning. And yesterday I stopped, and I saw this column from The Telegraph. And I just want to read it to you. We should ban children from social media before it ruins their futures. Luckily, my son, writes Michael Deacon, parliamentary sketch writer, that means columnist in British. Luckily, my son is too young to know what social media is, but when he finds out, I'm going to prohibit him from using it for his own good. I was going to start by saying that social media is the most dangerous invention since the nuclear bomb. But then I realized that would be an absurd piece of hyperbole. After all, you can easily argue that nuclear weapons help to preserve peace. On social media, by contrast, people do nothing but fight. So really, social media is far worse. There are two main reasons it is so dreadful. The first is that it's full of people expressing opinions we disagree with. Before the advent of social media, that wasn't anything we had to put up with all that much. That was because we formed friendships with people who thought much the same way we did. We married people who thought much the same we did. And we only read whichever newspaper best reflected the world as we saw it. Of course, we were at least dimly aware that in society as a whole, there existed people who held opinions that were different from our own. But we tended not to marry those people or read their newspapers. As a result, we were able to live undisturbed in our happy, soundproof little bubbles, Deacon continues. Social media, however, has made that impossible. Because on social media, we're perpetually bombarded by opinions different from our own and links to articles that contradict or even ridicule our view of the world. The experience is both confusing and upsetting. Until now, we simply had no idea that other people were so stupid, rude, and intolerant. Why can't they just be intelligent, pleasant, and generous like us? In short, we were a lot better off when we didn't know what other people thought all the time. And by the same token, we were a lot better off when people didn't know what we thought all the time. Either. Because this is the second big problem with social media. The opinions we express on it can be held against us, not just now, but for the rest of our lives. As reported in The Telegraph this week, children are now being warned that their future careers could be jeopardized by their old tweets and online comments. A tweet considered offensive can be recorded by the police as a non-crime hate incident, which will show up when prospective employers carry out a background check. It could easily put those employers off. Even if the police don't get involved, a childhood tweet can still cost you your job. Take the recent example of Alexi McAmmon. Last month, she lost her new job as editor of Teen Vogue after it was discovered that 10 years earlier, as a teenager, she posted a tweet grumbling about her class's stupid Asian teaching assistant, and another tweet saying she was googling how not to wake up with swollen Asian eyes. But the story didn't quite end there. Among the call of those who called for McCammon's sacking was Kristen Davitt, Teen Vogue's social media manager. It emerged then that 11 years earlier, as a teenager, Davitt herself had posted tweets featuring a racial slur. Davitt, thankfully for her, remains in her job. How alarming, though, to think that you could be fired for a view that you held as a teenager. Indeed, fired for a view that you may never really have held at all. Rather than the public proclamation of some deep-seated belief, it may have simply been an immature expression of annoyance, an unthinking use of slang, or even a joke intended to amuse a tiny band of friends who follow you online. Yet now, years or even decades later, it's cost you your job, your prospects, your ability to pay your rent. You're being punished as an adult for your sins as a child, sins that at the time you committed them may not even have been considered sins at all. But these days, the past is invariably judged by the standards of the present. Remember Brett Kavanaugh's high school yearbook? Which means that on social media, you not only have to avoid offending people who might read your words now, you also have to avoid offending people who might read your words 10 or 20 years from now, which isn't easy, because you have no idea which might cause offense in 10 or 20 years. Eating meat, driving a car, enjoying Mrs. Brown's boys, your guess is as good as mine. All I can say is I'm glad we didn't have social media when I was a teenager, writes Deacon. Goodness knows how many of today's ethical certainties I would have violated 25 years in advance. Luckily, my son is young, too young to even know what social media is. But when he finds out, I'm going to ban him from using it for his own good. No doubt he'll be angry and consider it cruel, unfair, but I'm sure he'll come around to my point of view in a decade or three. The risk simply isn't worth it. Forget buying your children books and taking them to museums and hiring them a private tutor. If you want to boost their career prospects, the best thing you can do is rip their phone from their hand and smash it to bits. John Michael Deacon in the Telegraph. That is 100% on target. I am so, so glad. I had many opinions when I was young, but nobody cared. When I worked in the White House, 85 to 86, I was the junior lawyer. I mean, I was lowest man on the totem pole and woman on the totem pole. There were a very, very diverse group of very smart people. Sherry Cooksey, David Waller, Michael Luttig, the Chief Justice of the United States, Fred Fielding. Dick Houser was on that staff. Dick has a 3 handicap. We didn't see him much, but he was on the staff. He was around. His golf club was often on his desk, so I know he was there. But then I was the junior person in charge of defending the seal of the presidency of the United States, and I was damn good at it. If some limo company used that seal, I was all over them like flies on a screen door. I stopped it dead in its track. You had to figure out how the 25th Amendment worked. You asked the Chief Justice, the future Chief Justice. We had a little machine there that could look into the future, and they'd ask him. But if they needed the seal of the president, I was all over it. But I cannot imagine having had social media when I was 20. Nobody cared what you thought. They gave you assignments to do. And when I was at DOJ, to Attorney General, nobody cared what I thought. They just gave me tasks. Look this up, look that up. Review these warrants for FISA application. Even when I was the general counsel, nobody cared. At OPM, even when I ran OPM as the acting director after everybody quit towards the end of the Reagan years, I was a big boss. Nobody in the government cares what the head of OPM thinks. My goodness, let's be real. I'm glad I wasn't tweeting on the morning that I had to go in the middle of a snowstorm and shut down the government. Goodness knows what I would have tweeted about Metro then and what it would have done to my career. Terrible, terrible, terrible. All right, look, I want to continue for you on Peter Thiel. Yesterday, after Peter Thiel teed off on Bitcoin, let me play that for you again. Cut number 17, Peter Thiel at the Nixon Seminar, which you can look at, nixonseminar.com, on Tuesday night. Cut 17.
From China's point of view, they want to get, they don't like the U.S. having this reserve currency because it gives us, you know, a lot of leverage over, you know, Iranian oil supply chains and all sorts of things like that. They don't want the renminbi to become a reserve currency, because then you have to open your capital account and you have to do all sorts of things that they really don't want to do. I think the euro, you could think of as, you know, was in part a Chinese weapon against the dollar. It didn't, in the last decade, it hasn't quite worked out that way, but that was, you know, China would have liked to see two reserve currencies like the euro. And, even though I'm sort of a pro-crypto, pro-Bitcoin maximalist person, I do wonder whether at this point Bitcoin is also should also be thought in part of as a Chinese financial weapon against the U.S., where it threatens fiat money, but it especially threatens the U.S. Dollar, and China wants to do things to weaken it. So it's sort of China is long Bitcoin, and perhaps from a geopolitical perspective, the U.S. should be a little bit be asking some tougher questions about exactly how that works. But some internal stablecoin.
Secretary Pompeo added this. Mike Pompeo was also at the Nixon seminar on Tuesday night. Cut 18.
If I understand what they're doing is they're digitizing their currency. So separate from Bitcoin, it's still fiat currency, right? That is still Chinese money that they are now digitizing. It has huge impacts for their surveillance capacity. They would pitch it as anti-fraud. You can prevent fraud from taking place. I suppose that's true. this is something I think they believe will reduce the costs of cross-border transactions as well for the Chinese. Your point about not wanting to be a reserve currency, I think, is right. I think they'd like it to be among a mix. They want to make sure that when Secretary Pompeo issues the sanctions against the Iranian leadership, that there is a way to purchase Iranian oil that we don't have the capacity to either seize, understand, or impact. And so I do think these digital currencies, separate from Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies, are something you'll see more countries go to. The United States has a project where we're working on it too, but we will be slow off the gate. It has lots of implications for us here at home. And my guess is that we will not be the leader in this forefront, where an authoritarian regime like China sees nearly all upside from having the capacity to issue currency or take away currency from people who act in ways that are inconsistent with Xi Jinping thought.
I must tell you, it was a fascinating 90 minutes, and you can watch clips of it. NixonSeminar.com. It's co-chaired by Mike Pompeo and Robert O'Brien. Dr. Henry Kissinger is our honorary chair. And there are members. There are 15 members of the seminar. And we're not taking applications. Please don't. Lots of people sent me emails. I want to join the seminar. It's full. We've done it. Jonathan Burks, Lonnie Chen, Christopher Cox, Dr. Monica Crowley, Mike Gallagher, Congressman Extraordinaire, Alex Gray, Mary Kissel, John Noonan, Morgan Ortegas, Matt Pottinger, Kimberly Reed, Dr. Nadia Shadlow, Congressman Michael Waltz, Christian Witten, Alex Wong. So we got basically the 15 smartest people on national security under the age of 50, plus Pompeo and O'Brien and Dr. Kissinger, and we bring in people like Thiel, and we do it once a month, and then people can watch it. You have to join the Nixon Foundation to be able to watch it, but we also post every article that everybody in that seminar writes. So if you want to be smart on what's going on in the world, go to NixonSeminar.com and hit the articles in the seminar. Watch this thing with Thiel. It's amazing. Welcome back, America. It's Hugh Hewitt. I'm standing by for Michael Oren, waiting to see if we can find... Oh, he's there. Dr. Oren, good morning. How are you?
I'm here.
I'm good. I just described Israeli politics as a Rubik's Cube that no one can solve, so the answer is to hold another election. And I honestly, I've read everything I can. I have no idea what's going on. You have the floor.
Thank you. That's like, you know, there's an old joke about that Lyndon Johnson's speechwriter, you know, used to put on little cue cards, and Johnson got up there one day and says, I'm going to solve the war. I'm going to win the war on poverty. I'm going to win the war on drugs. And he gets to the last card. And a speechwriter writes, okay, Lyndon, now you're on your own. Okay. Same thing. Okay,
yep.
I'm on. Listen, as long as Benjamin Netanyahu is in politics, this is going to be the result. Period. You know, if he were to leave politics, you'd have a situation of like a, you know, a cue ball hitting all the other balls and they go into different pockets. But as long as he's there, that then, you know, there's not going to be any break. And it's always going to be an anti-BB camp. It's going to be divided. It can't get together because there's leftists and rightists and ups and downs. And there's a pro-BB camp, which is far more united. Now, some of the ultra-Orthodox parties have indicated that if they go to a fifth round, they will not be, they will no longer be in Netanyahu's pocket. That's what they say. But I don't know whether there'll even be voter turnout for the next election, because voter turnout went down precipitously last time. People just fed up. And it's causing a huge crisis of credibility in our political system. Now, having all said all that, Israel's probably the world's highest functioning anarchy.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
Country works great.
Country, and don't screw around with it, Iran, because all of a sudden all these quarreling people will blow you up. And so just take that to the bank. I am curious, though. There is this one path to a government which involves Naftali Bennett rejoining Likud and sitting as a minority government with the support of, what is it, Ra'am, an Islamist party,
yeah.
Not joining the government, but supporting it. Now that was fairly common in British politics in the 19th century when the Irish votes would support whichever government was in, and when they withdrew them, the government would fall. How realistic is that?
Not terribly, because there are people in Bennett's party or people in the even more right-wing sort of settler party of Bezalel Smotrich, who said that they will not sit in the government, even if it's implicitly supported by Ra'am. They will not lean on that staff. And, you know, frankly, they have a very strong case. It's interesting. You know, a couple days ago, a Palestinian terrorist was released from the jail. He had killed an Israeli soldier 35 years ago, an Israeli Arab, by the way, not from the West Bank. And his sentence was commuted, and he went home to his village and received a hero's welcome. Hero's welcome. People danced in the street, gave out sweets. And there were members of Knesset from this ROM party who hugged this guy. So
that does present a problem. I see that.
That's
what
a
about
huge problem.
What about defectors from SARS, Paul? I mean, can they offer them? You can have the transportation ministry. You can be the chancellor of the exchequer, which I know you don't have, but there's got to be something like it. Are there three people to be bribed over?
And there have been cases. You know, back in 1993, the Oslo Peace Accords with the PLO was famously won by one vote, and the person who gave that vote had been in opposition, and he got an SUV. The famous SUV for PLO. And so there have been precedents. I think today, in the age of transparency and social media, it's much more difficult to defect. People know about it in advance. The obloquy, the fallout from it is far, far greater. So far there have been no defections. There have been rumors of what Netanyahu has been offering to defectors, anything, you know, the sky and the earth and everything in between. Right now, I've been saying on this program for weeks, right? It's either going to be Bibi or fifth round. And I'm sticking with that.
Well, that's the Rubik's Cube. And so we go back to the Rubik's Cube. That means Netanyahu remains prime minister in the interim, right? Gantz mm-hmm. remains defense minister in the interim, right? And then when do we have the next round? Is it going to be July 4th election? I mean, when's it going to be?
It's much further than that next week, because it goes – now they have – each party will have like 24, 21 days to form a government. That gives us up to, you know, it's 42 days plus another 14 days plus holidays. I mean, it's going to bring you well into the summer. Before you know it, you're at the Jewish holidays in September. It goes on and on. You know, I think I've said on this program several times that Netanyahu is a lot of like some of the enemies we fight, you know, Hamas and Hezbollah, who in order to win only have not to lose, right?
And
by not losing, Bibi kind of wins, doesn't he?
Will the trial be over ever so that they'd have a clean break?
No, the trial is expected to go on for 3 years.
Oh, my gosh. You know, this is really a broken record. And I'm just curious, in the next election, do people just stay home?
Yeah, and that's what's happening. People losing credibility. Now, there are two exits, possible exits. One is that Netanyahu cuts a deal with the state controller's office, the state prosecutor's office. And, you know, sort of, you know, Ford and Nixon. And he's against that. Every DNA is against that. But he may go for it. The other one is that he opts to be president of the state of Israel. And there's a kind of a scuttlebutt here that says if he were to stand for president and the Knesset votes for the president, that the people who hate Bibi would vote for him just to get him out of politics.
Telling you, we'll find out next week in the longest running installment on this show what's happening in Israel. Michael, thank you. Dr. Michael Oren on Twitter. Stay tuned, America. I'm back, America. It's Hugh Hewitt. Good morning to you. I'm joined for the first time, of which I hope are many occasions, by Mayor Quinton Lucas of Kansas City, Missouri. He is probably the toughest Democrat, if he runs for Senate next year, that Republicans will have to beat. He's also a very good mayor of Kansas City. Good morning, Mayor. How are you?
Good morning, and it's an honor to be back with you.
Now, you know, Mayor, we're not going to agree on a lot of things, but I think I want to begin on an area of common ground that where you and I are bound to agree. Isn't that make sense? We're bound to agree on one thing.
I imagine that would be the case. I'm ready for it.
Here it is. Let's play the audio.
First half defensively allowed the fewest points, but the Browns are trying to defy that. Is it hit? As he fumbled through the end zone.
Now, I got to tell you, Mayor, any fair-minded football fan, even a Kansas City Chiefs fan, knows that Rashard Higgins was speared by safety Daniel Sorensen, and that turned that game around. And any self-respecting NFL fan would say the Browns should have been awarded that game, and the Chiefs' AFC title is simply illegitimate.
Oh my. Well, you know, I think, first of all, we've seen a Chiefs dynasty budding only stopped by that New England relocation down to Tampa this year. But I am one who hopes for the best for the Browns. It was so exciting to see you all get back to the playoffs, try to make a run. But Kansas City deserved it. Me, every gambler in America, everybody in this part of the Midwest knew the right team came out on top.
Now, you know Daniel Sorensen spared him. You're a man of justice. I read your website. You believe in justice. You know he spared him, and that fumble through the end zone rule is the worst rule in the NFL. But I digress. Do you also know that the Indians beat the Royals 4-2 yesterday on two Jose Ramirez home runs?
You know, I did know that. it's been an otherwise great start to the Kansas City Royals, but Indians, a solid franchise that, you know, we have great respect for. We'll be seeing them, of course, a lot this summer. So look forward to evening things up a bit.
Oh, Mayor, you are a diplomat. All right, so I came trash talking to you about my Browns and my Indians, and you're just being nice. Let's get to the real stuff. Are you going to run for Senate in Missouri?
You know, I have not made that decision yet. We continue to have a lot of work to do in Kansas City. As you may or may not know, I was somewhat involved in the St. Louis mayor's race and excited about that to see Tashara Jones, the first black woman elected as a mayor of St. Louis. I think that, you know, Missouri and Democrats in Missouri have a good chance to make a difference. It starts in the cities, it expands to suburbs, and I hope someone carries that message in 2022. I'm evaluating if I'll be the right one for that, but certainly I think I have some things that suggest I could be.
Well, yeah, I actually read the internals from the Republican side, and they're worried about you. And so when they're worried about you, I want to cover you. And I really would actually talk policy with you this morning because I have been working on a story about Los Angeles homelessness, and it's actually epidemic out in California now, 70,000 homeless people in L.A. How many homeless people does Kansas City have, and what are you doing about it? Genuinely interested, most intractable problem in America today is homelessness and the unhoused. What's going on in Kansas City, Missouri?
Well, you're absolutely right that it is a problem that is one that's growing, I think, all around America and every large city. In Kansas City right now, it's estimated we have about 1,800 to 2,000 homeless persons. If you break down percentages, Los Angeles is still, even per capita, in a tougher place than we are. And, you know, we have always had encampments. The estimate is there are about 170. I've actually been meeting with folks who are representatives of the homeless community and indeed are experiencing homelessness themselves every day this week. And this was not just set up for this interview.
I didn't know that.
We are planning to do a few different things. One, are creating more transitional opportunities at hotels for between 30 and 90 days to get people back on their feet. We're giving them COVID vaccines, et cetera. But something I think that's more important, and for all of you who talk about, you know, teach a man to fish rather than giving him one, we're looking at converting some of our vacant houses, of which we have more than we would like, and having them fixed up, working with local unions and others, making them opportunities for those who are homeless right now to get in there, to live, to continue to have all the support services, mental health services, et cetera, that you need, and then hopefully to address the problem long term rather than moving from one camp to another, putting people under a bridge, as I think they've done in another California jurisdiction. We're saying, how can we actually use some of this federal money that all of us as cities are getting right now to try to solve a long-term problem? And I think that's the way that we'll make this change. I think Kansas City is going to be unique in having a solution for it.
Well, you know, there are 70,000 unhoused people in L.A., and L.A. is getting a couple of billion dollars. I don't know what Eric Garcetti is going to do with it. But I, having gone to the hearing on Skid Row, having followed it closely with Judge David Carter, he's about to take the city into receivership, I think, and take over because it's such a disaster here. And, you know, my simple suggestion is buy houses and move people into them. It sounds like, I don't know how much money you're getting in the stimulus. Do you yet know, Mayor Q?
You know, we're getting $200 million, which, you know, a lot of cities are getting a lot more, but that means a lot to us.
Now, $200 million would go a long way to buying housing stock or restoring housing stock. But then, it's my experience, there are three kinds of homeless. People have mental illness, people have addiction, and people have economic problems. That's in the reverse order of difficulty to deal with. The people who have economic problems are actually kind of easy to deal with if you can find them and give them rapid rehousing. What are you going to do about the mental health and the addicted, though?
You know, I think both of those need a sustained set of touches. So I have spent a lot of time with some of our law enforcement in Kansas City. And I think what you see, and I'll talk to them, they say, oh, I've interacted with that guy 40 different times. He's been arrested this number of times. But usually it's a relationship where either you go to jail or the emergency room because you got in a fight. You may get meds for a second. There's not that follow-up counseling. There's not that follow-up social work service. And so for us, it would be really making sure that folks are enrolled in programs, that there are some measures to ensure compliance. In our municipal court, that relates to some punitive measures. But you've seen exceptional ways that we've dealt with these things. For example, we have a veterans tiny home village in Kansas City, started by a group of our vets, now former Senate candidate Jason Kander works with it, and they have made amazing changes for some of our folks who are dealing with long-term issues. We have a drug abuse treatment court, right, veterans treatment courts, investing more in those. And these have started around the country. They have amazing changes and differences from people, and I've talked to them, who said, I never thought I would get off of, let's say it's meth, and they never thought that they had been in a position to be a homeowner, to have a steady job. I mean, it's going to take that level of commitment. But importantly, and this is a place where I agree with a lot of conservatives, it is not just throwing money to the first thing. If there is a critique I had of perhaps how this city did things often, we would get millions of dollars from HUD every year, we still do, and then we just pass it all out. And we say, all right, we're done. And then, some of our nonprofit partners say, all right, well, we've passed ours out, so we're all done. That is useless and getting you nowhere. You need to actually measure how these programs are going. You need to change course if they're not. And, for example, the buying houses sort of thing may be a heck of a lot more effective than, just spending $3 million to help pay for administrative salaries at X or Y nonprofit because we always have done it that way.
You know, Mayor, that brings me to one of my favorite suggestions to municipal authorities is when the government shows up with $200 million for Kansas City, Missouri, don't spend it, bank it, and then use the interest for a housing trust. That would be $8 to $10 million a year that would be ongoing as opposed to a one-time shot in the arm. Have you considered that? Is that anything that you would ever put down? And let's talk about putting the money into investments and making it a housing trust.
You know, to the extent legally permitted, we absolutely would consider that. And in fact, that is something that as we consider ideas, one that comes high to the list. How do you actually fund a sustainable corpus of money that can actually support our goals long term rather than just spending up all of the taxpayer dollars, whether they be federal, state, or local, because they are all still taxpayer dollars, as soon as possible? And there is one thing that I see as a concern right now, which is that I think too many of us in local government and state governments are saying, oh my God, we have money. What are we going to put it into? Right? And you even are getting, I'm getting a lot more requests from people saying, we need all this now. Instead of saying, okay, you know what? We all got to bail out. All of us, actually, red states, blue states, from the federal government, from the federal taxpayer. How do we make sure that we're in a position where hopefully you never have a crisis like this, but the next economic downturn, we're able to weather it because we said, all right, we've addressed this housing issue up front. We've addressed some of our mental health issues up front. That's the difference I think we can make in Kansas City. And that's what, I had somebody, another mayor of a Missouri town, we were actually talking about the Senate race, among other things, and he said they're Democrats, they're Republicans, and they're mayors. I see my goal as a mayor having long-term solutions because you got to solve the thing. Right, you don't have a chance to write these checks or have some of these battles that other people do, and I think that's what we're going to be planning in Kansas City.
You're sounding very reasonable, except on the Chiefs, Mayor. That's dangerous for Republicans. I want to know, Eric Schmidt's coming on. I've talked to Eric Reitens. I've talked to one of the other Republicans running out there. There are like 1,000 of them running for Senate. Who do you want to run against? You probably want to run against Eric Reitens, don't you?
Well, I think everybody's our viewpoints are going to be different across the board. I've met most of them, I think. I think Governor Greitens, somebody who resigned in disgrace not that long ago, that should likely disqualify you from further office. But I am unlikely to be a Republican primary voter, so I imagine I don't care what the heck I'll say. I think the others have in some ways lost their way. I have respect for the Attorney General, Eric Schmidt, but I disagree with the lawsuits against China that have gotten dismissed from court, lawsuits relating to the election, which also got dismissed from court, and many see as linked to the January 6th incidents in Washington. I mean, look, there is a question of are we going to do serious governance or not? To show that I'm actually not just a partisan. Roy Blunt, our outgoing senior senator, has always been largely about just responsible government. How are you doing substantive political acts every day? And instead of the sort of thing that is, let's just try to get headlines everywhere. I think you can get on the Hugh Hewitt show and actually be good at governance, not just somebody who's, you know, flamethrowing all the time. And I think Missourians are going to respect and appreciate that. That's been in our tradition for generations.
So last question, Mayor Q, what is your timeline? When do you have to decide if you're going to make a run for the Senate seat? Because I really do think Republicans are overlooking a big vulnerability in the show me state if you get in this race. I just want to know when we have to start watching it closely.
Well, you know, we've addressed, I think, a few important budget concerns. Kansas City passed one a few weeks ago. I do want to make sure we figure out our stimulus planning. That'll be in over the next several weeks. I would imagine that, like a lot of other people, the summer months give a little bit of time to think about it. You know, maybe I'll get around Missouri a bit more. I do vacation in the Ozarks, among other places. And so I'll continue calling folks, talking to them, and listening to what's going on. You know, my primary job is looking out for my family. The next is looking out for my city. But, you know, I think we need strong voices in the Capitol who are looking out for Missourians, not just either their book deals or what's going on with some other things politically. So it'll be over the next several months, and I hope I'd have the chance to come back and talk to you more about it along the way.
Oh, often, especially during the season, especially when we take on the Chiefs again and beat them. And great to make your acquaintance, Mayor Q. I wish more Democrats would come on and chat like this, because it's in the best interest of everyone. Have a great day, but don't expect the Royals to do other than what they did yesterday. Lose to the Indians today. Good to talk to you, Mayor.
Hey, good luck. Stay well.
Welcome back, America. It's Hugh Hewitt, joined now by former United States Senator from Missouri, Jim Talent. Senator, good morning. How are you?
Well, I'm fine. You've got a lot of heavyweights from Missouri on this morning.
It's Missouri Day. And Quentin Lucas, it didn't line up this way. We've got Eric Schmidt on next hour. It just happened to work out. And then you're in between. He's a formidable candidate, Jim Talent.
Well, yeah. I mean, I would agree with that. Now, I think that there's no reason in the world Missouri shouldn't hold this seat for the Republicans. And as a matter of fact, keep it really off the radar screen. But we have to nominate somebody who can make the election about the issues, which is the tax increases, Biden's border policies, what he's going to do to defense, the whole ball of wax. If the election is about what somebody was doing in their basement 3 years ago, then we could have a problem. And you know what I'm talking about.
I do, and so does Quentin Lucas. And you know, you heard he thinks Eric Greitens is going to be nominated because he immediately began to attack Eric Greitens. I didn't expect that, but we'll come back around on that. But that's what he's hoping for, right? Democrats like to pick their opponents in Missouri.
Yeah, and I think that's a pretty clear message to Republicans about who ought to be nominated or ought not to be nominated.
Yeah.
Now, elections are about what people are talking about. I mean, this, I think, is the clearest way of putting it. So, and you managed it in your interview with Governor Greitens, which I thought was very fair. I mean, if he's the nominee, the elections are going to be about his personal scandals, what he was doing in the basement, what happened with his nonprofit. And I don't want it to be about that. I want it to be about the national issues, and in particular what the Biden administration is doing and whether Democrats like Mayor Lucas would be supporters of the Biden agenda, which I think they would be. Okay?
And so, every election is a national election now in the Senate. Every election.
Exactly. And this is something I don't think Governor Greitens understands. I mean, I've been through this. And it's the way it was when I was running, times 10 now. These are Senate races are watched internationally. They're funded internationally. And everything about Eric Greitens is going to come out. And look, if he wanted to vindicate himself, I'm talking about Governor Greitens, he should have stayed in office and fought it out. That's what Donald Trump did when he was attacked, right? He stayed in office and fought it out. That was the opportunity to do it, not in a Senate race, which is about a lot bigger issues than any one individual.
Now, I wanted to ask you, with regards to the Senate as a whole, Joe Manchin has an op-ed in the Washington Post in which he declares, I'm not going to change the filibuster. And by the way, reconciliation should not replace regular order. I was very cheered by that. What did you think?
Yeah, and he's not the only one. I mean, I think there were seven Democrats who voted against waiving the Byrd rule. Put the minimum wage bill on the stimulus bill that they passed. There's always maneuvering around what you can and can't put on reconciliation. You remember ANWR, the Arctic National Wildlife Reserve.
Yep.
When I was in the Senate, we were able to reshape the bill to put it on reconciliation. So this is more or less normal, this kind of maneuvering, but not to try and pass, you know, regulatory bills, normal kinds of bills and reconciliation. Manchin's right, and I think he speaks probably for a half dozen Democrats.
What about the idea that Chuck Schumer has a ruling from the parliamentarian that says he can amend the reconciliation instructions and thereby get another bite at the apple, indeed an infinite bite at the apple, with 51 votes?
Well, in the first place, that's what Chuck Schumer says. So let's see if that's what the parliamentarian really is saying. And let's get the details of it. Okay. And also, I have to go back and research this. I mean, I think there have been years when they passed more than one reconciliation bill, but that doesn't mean you can put anything on reconciliation. But, you know, you can put tax changes on reconciliation. And the process by which you do it, by the way, is pretty difficult. Well, let's have a vote on these tax changes. I mean, Biden's already backing away from the corporate stuff.
Yes,
right?
He is. Yes, yeah. He is.
And so, well, let's see if they can get 50 votes for these. I mean, I have a feeling they can. Tax increases aren't very popular.
Yeah.
I mean, what we've seen so far is they've spent an enormous amount of money, and now they want enormous tax increases. And that's really what they did in 2009, too.
And Jamie Dimon said yesterday there's going to be a boom. And there has to be a boom when you spend this much money. Money's got to go somewhere. It's going to go into stocks and real estate. When does that boom end in your experience, Jim? Is it a year? Well, is it 2 years?
I'm not sure there's going to be a boom. When you funnel it through the networks and the apparatuses they're funneling it through, I don't know how economically productive that is.
Oh, interesting.
They passed a $900 billion stimulus in 2009, predicted 4% growth. And what do we get? Like 1% growth? I mean, it was a recovery that looked like a recession. So I'm not so sure we're going to have a boom. There'll be a recovery of kind. Let's see what the economy does with this.
Wow, that's very, very interesting. Jim Talent, always a pleasure. Because when Jamie Dimon says boom, I usually believe him. But you're right. We were supposed to have a boom.
Right. I mean, I'm not an economist. I'm just an old Midwestern politician.
Yeah, sure you are. Just like Quentin Lucas is, Mayor Q. Good to have you, Senator. Follow him at Jim Talent on Twitter. Follow me to hour number three. Steve Stivers of Ohio, Mo Brooks of Alabama, Eric Schmidt of Missouri. They're all coming up on the Hugh Hewitt Show. Morning, Glory America. Bonjour. Hi, Canada. It's Hugh Hewitt. Thank you for listening this morning. Now, we folks in northeastern Ohio, from Warren and Ashtabula, we're not really sure about Ripley, Ohio. We are told it is part of the Buckeye State, but it is so far to the south, we're a little bit unsure of that. Congressman Steve Stivers is the representative for the Ohio's 15th Congressional District, butting up down there along Kentucky. Good morning, Congressman. Welcome.
Hey, good morning, Hugh. It's great to be with you this morning. And, it's true. I'm from southern Ohio, and I'm a Reds fan, and they're 5-0. And I need to crow now because I'm not sure they'll have that good a season.
Yeah, I've never, ever been against the Reds, but you're probably a Bungles fan, too. And I love beating the Bungles.
It's been a really tough couple decades to be a Bengals fan, but I'm still a Bengals fan. And Joe Burrow's another great Ohio kid who's really done well. He's from my district, and I'm looking forward to great things from him. If they have a line that can protect him, maybe he'll be okay.
Yeah, they're going to draft a tackle, I think, in the first round. Now, Congressman Stivers, do you have the Bobcats, Ohio University, in your district, or are they somewhere else?
I do have the Bobcats. They're in my district, and, they had a nice little run. They helped bust my bracket along with my Ohio State Buckeyes, who lost in the first round to Oral Roberts University. So,
And they broke the heart of Fred Barnes, a UVA Cavalier through and through. But the Bobcats, I didn't even know that was a degree-granting institution. My son went to Miami, so we were never really sure of that. I guess they got under the junior college exemption. Let me get serious with you, Congressman. And by the way, Major General Stivers, I assume you're still on active duty in the Ohio National Guard. Am I right about that?
I am. I just got promoted to Major General in January. Yes, sir. Thanks.
Congratulations. And how often do you have to show up in that job as a Major General? It's kind of hard to do that on a couple of weeks a year basis, isn't it?
It is. I do it more than that. I probably end up doing National Guard drills 2 or 3 days a month. I end up doing a few weeks through the year as well. And obviously it's a little different when you're a major general. I end up doing it in smaller clumps because there's things I have to go to do to speak to troops or to give a speech to somebody or to, you know, check on how folks are doing with a mission. But it's not usually as long in duration as, you know, when I was a captain or a major.
Does that take you all over the state or does it keep you in your district? I would imagine a major general in the Ohio National Guard has to go everywhere.
It takes me all over the state and sometimes all over the country.
Have you been blessed to be able to go to Warren, Ohio, seat of the Western Reserve and home of all things good and true and noble?
Absolutely have. And we have just not too far from there. We have the Ravenna Arsenal that is now called Camp James A. Garfield that is a great place that we do some tank maneuvers, and our National Guard soldiers can do a ton of stuff there because it's a giant base. So it's we're really blessed to have that in Ohio.
We are hoping that Ravenna becomes a point in the missile defense program. I'm not sure if that decision has been made yet, but I know the Valley really wants missile defense to go into Ravenna.
It would have been great. The East Coast Missile Defense, they've delayed that decision. We were in the top three, so some places in New York. There are two sites in New York State. There is a site in Michigan around Battle Creek and a site at Ravenna. So I'm still, hopeful. It looks like they were, in second place, not first place, but last I heard the Defense Department delayed that decision. So I don't think it's officially been made.
Now we got to go over and work our friends on the House Armed Services. So Congressman, I'm keeping an open mind on the Ohio Senate race, and I want to have everyone on who's going to be, so it's going to take most of my show for the rest of the year, because honestly, there are like 20 people running. Have you made up your mind yet whether you're going to go for the seat being vacated by Rob Portman?
Well, thanks, Hugh. I have not made up my mind yet, but I announced yesterday we raised $1.4 million in the quarter. I believe that's actually going to be the biggest haul of any of the candidates. One of the candidates announced that she raised $2.1 million, but I have a very strong suspicion there's a seven-figure check, personal check, in that total. So I think we've outraised the field as a non-announced candidate, which I feel pretty good about. It says that there's a real opportunity for me, and there's a lot of support for me. I'm the only one in the field who's actually been a legislator at the state level and the federal level who's passed a bill. One of the other candidates was a state rep for 4 years and didn't pass a single bill. And life isn't just about passing bills. It's about getting things done and fighting for what's important. I know I can do that because I have done it. I voted 92% of the time with President Trump on issues. But at the same time, as a general and a military guy, I do think everybody should be treated with respect. And I have to admit, sometimes I felt like the president didn't always treat people well. And so I did have some differences with the president, but they weren't usually on policy. And I think he was taking the country in the right direction. We had a record-breaking economy. I want to get to work and get us back to that because we need it.
Now, Congressman, when we've got the Ohio State University grads, and Josh Mandel, J.D. Vance, and you, and two Marines, Vance and Mandel, and an Army guy, you, they are not major generals. You are. And then you've got over here Jane Timken. I begin to think maybe the last man standing is going to be the woman because she's the only woman in the race. Does that worry you?
It doesn't. I think people will grade us on what we've done. And when you look through everybody's resume, I like Jane. She was a good state party chair, but she really hasn't done much else so that she doesn't have the sort of paradigm to view very important decisions at the in the United States Senate that the others do as former state elected officials and military officers and or enlisted folks in both their cases. So it's I think she's a nice lady, and I think she'd be a great senator. If she's our nominee, I'll support her, but I'm not sure that just being a woman is going to get her through the primary.
Now, I'm going to come to Cleveland at WHK and host a debate. Everybody kind of trusts me in this. Can we get you up for that one when it happens, Congressman?
If I'm in the race, I'll be there for sure.
And when do you make that decision? When do you think you have to make that decision by?
I figure I've got the rest of this next quarter, as long as I'm continuing to gain support, I think I can make the decision. I think the 4th of July is kind of a symbolic time to think about freedom and the future of our country, and it's kind of a good time for me to have made a decision by, in my opinion, because the freedom of our country is at stake, and I think that's a great time to decide what I'm going to do.
Now, Congressman, I spent Tuesday night with Peter Thiel at the Nixon seminar and Mike Pompeo and Robert O'Brien, and Peter Thiel pushed $10 million into a fund that's going to help J.D. Vance. What's your reaction to that?
Well, you know, you have to raise the hard money as well. So that $10 million, you probably know, I ran the House Campaign Committee in 2018. That $10 million in a super PAC pays 2.5 times a higher rate than the candidate rate. So it spends like about $4 million, but it's still serious money. And it, frankly, there's a lot of things you can't do in a super PAC. So if J.D. Vance is going to do this, he's still going to have to raise real money, not just get one big check from somebody he used to work for. And okay. You know, it's great that somebody believes in you that much, but that's not going to be enough to win a race.
So my question is, on that debate stage, when we have, you know, a half dozen people running, because I guess a couple of your colleagues might get in as well, what's going to be the issue that differentiates Congressman Stivers from Josh Mandel, from Jane Timken, from J.D. Vance?
Number one, it's experience. I know how to get things done. I've done it. Number two, I don't just talk. I've actually, you know, done stuff. And I think those are two important things. And I believe my military record, the fact that, you know, it's great to serve your country, and several of us have, but I've served for 35 years and been promoted to the rank of major general, two-star general, which I think shows that I know how to get things done. I think those are some really important points that the voters of Ohio need to learn. And when they learn them, I feel confident that they'll be for me.
Well, keep coming back on, Congressman, and I look forward to seeing you on the stage up in Cleveland when we do that, maybe in Columbus as well. But with all those Buckeyes around, I don't know who's going to out-Buckeye everybody else, but it certainly doesn't hurt to come from the university. But remember,
it does not.
That Ohio University, be very careful about their degrees, Congressman. Very, very careful. We Miami people are suspicious of that. Be well.
Both my parents went to Miami, so I...
Oh, they did? Okay, so you know. Yeah. You know the real school is Miami.
I do.
Thank you, Congressman. Don't go anywhere, America. I'm going to come right back. I've got two more Senate candidates coming up. Representative Mo Brooks is going to join me. He just got endorsed by Donald Trump in Alabama. Missouri Attorney General Eric Schmidt is going to join me. He is going to be running in Missouri. It's sort of like Senate 2022 today. Stay tuned. It's the Hugh Hewitt Show.
Don't forget to sign up for The Hughniverse, all of Hugh's broadcasts on demand, The After Show, which, in my opinion, is worth the price all by itself, Dwayne FM, and all sorts of bonus content. www.hughniverse.com.
Welcome back, America. Hugh Hewitt, joined now by Congressman Mo Brooks of Alabama. Good morning, Congressman. Great to have you on.
My pleasure, Hugh. Good to be on again with you.
Congratulations. Yesterday, Donald Trump endorsed you to replace the retiring Richard Shelby in the Senate in the great state of Alabama. That is tantamount to winning the nomination, I think. Did you go down and meet with the president first?
No, I've not seen the president in person since last year. We've had lots of telephone conversations, and I do intend on going down to Mar-a-Lago in a couple of weeks. It'll be nice to visit with him again.
Well, am I not correct that any Republican not named Roy Moore wins that seat if nominated, and getting President Trump's nomination or endorsement is a long way to getting the nomination?
Well, that's true in that about 99% of the statewide elections since 2010, the Republican nominee has won. Roy Moore, for a variety of reasons, unfortunately, was the only one who did not.
So do you expect other people to drop out now, Congressman?
We had the Alabama Secretary of State, John Merrill, drop out yesterday. He was number two in the polls. We've still got one other candidate who has announced. She's got very little name recognition, but she's a self-funder, put in around $5 million. We'll see how that plays out. There undoubtedly will be other candidates who will consider it, but as of this moment, it's a two-person race, and I'm up significantly in the polls over the actual and rumored candidates.
So you're going to go to the United States Senate, in my humble opinion. What is your goal?
I hope you're a sage and a prophet.
Well, I'm neither a prophet nor a son of a prophet, but I follow this stuff pretty closely. And I've had on this morning Steve Stivers, who's running in Ohio. Eric Schmidt is running in Missouri, is coming up next. Jim Talent's been on. I had Mayor Q of Kansas. I love the Senate races, so I kind of follow it closely. And I think you've got it in the bag. But my question is, what do you want to do when you get there?
Well, I want to do everything I can to defend and promote the foundational principles that have made America the greatest nation in world history. First and foremost would be the Bill of Rights. Our First Amendment freedom of speech is under attack. Our freedom of religion is under attack. Our Second Amendment right to bear arms is under attack. That's just the Bill of Rights. Then you've got whether we're going to continue to be a republic. Our election system is under attack by the socialists as they try to rig and steal elections. You've got moral values. They're the compass that guide a great nation to do good things rather than bad things with the power that they enjoy. And our moral values are under attack. I mean, some of the things that you just take for granted, like knowing the difference between a man and a woman. Apparently, socialist Democrats are confused about that, and they believe that it's perfectly fine to allow a man who pretends to be a woman to compete against women and women college athletics. That's science denial. But that's on the moral value side, and that's just kind of the tip of the iceberg. And then another big battle is socialism versus free enterprise. Free enterprise is based on liberty, freedom, as the name suggests. Socialism is dictatorial, top-down. Government tells you what you can and cannot do with your God-given talents. So socialism has never worked in any nation that's tried it. Free enterprise has worked. It's generated the greatest economy in the history of the world here in the United States of America, and that empowers us to do a lot of things that they otherwise could not do. So I'm going to be a staunch defender and supporter of free enterprise. The list just goes on and on and on. But I'll tell you, I'm not going to be a wallflower in the United States Senate. I'm a fighter, and I believe that our country is worth fighting for. And while these socialists have made significant gains in 2018 and 2020's election cycles, by golly, they're going to have to run me down to keep me from doing what I think our country needs doing to protect our stature as number one in the world.
Now, Congressman, you're on Armed Services, and I want to talk mostly about that. I'll come back to voting in a second. I want to talk about Armed Services. Can you persuade two or three of your colleagues across the aisle that if they're going to pass another couple of trillion dollars in so-called infrastructure spending, that we at least put some into shipbuilding and port construction and the defense of the United States, because we spent $6 trillion this year, and not a penny of it's been for defense spending?
I don't believe that I have the persuasive ability to convince a single socialist Democrat to do what you just suggested. And I don't know that anybody else in the United States Congress does either.
You only need four. Are there not four Democrats in the United States House of Representatives who will make the speaker spend some money on defense?
Well, spending money on defense is a little bit different than coming out of the infrastructure bill. We will have money spent on defense, but our defense expenditures, I'm sure, will come under attack
on
the Armed Services Committee in both the House and Senate side, and also in the Appropriations Committees. Whether we can resist those attacks, that's going to be the big battleground, and I'm not sure. But certainly we have a lot of socialist Democrats who are pacifists. And by the way, I'm somewhat hesitant, Hugh, about using the word Democrats. Democratic Party used to be an honorable institution. It no longer is. It's been hijacked by the socialist movement in America. And so I call them socialist Democrats or just plain socialists.
Now, I think you've got Congresswoman Luria, who is a commander in the United States Navy on armed services. Can't you get together with her and persuade someone to build some shipbuilding lines somewhere or cybersecurity or infrastructure? I mean, there've got to be some sane Democrats.
Well, I believe we will have that kind of debate, and some of those debates will be successful when we do the National Defense Authorization Act and when we do the appropriation bills related to defense. It just won't be in the context of the infrastructure bill that you brought up earlier. But having said that, please bear in mind that the socialists vote lockstep with each other as a block. We might get one defector or two defectors every now and then. But in the House of Representatives, even though it's a very, very close margin of majority for the Democrats over the Republicans that ensconces Nancy Pelosi in power, we have yet to win a single substantive vote on the floor of the House. And that gives you an idea as to how lockstep these radicals are as they walk arm in arm doing great damage to our country.
I've got to think that on the craziest parts of the tax bill, Congressman Brooks, like doing away with stepped up basis, which would just rob an entire generation of tens of billions of dollars of equity saved by their parents and grandparents, that some Democrats don't want to lose in 2022. And I mean, you're going to redistrict in 2022, and they're going to get wiped out if they do that.
Well, the so-called moderates in the Democratic Party ranks, if there are moderates left, they're in a real bind. If they vote for America, they lose their Democratic primary. If they vote with the radical socialist wing of their party, then they win their primary, but they're more apt to lose their general election. History has shown us that they are much more willing to take a chance at losing in a general election than they are at losing in a Democrat primary. Hence, they vote lockstep with their colleagues. They may have some reservations about some of the things that the socialists are doing on Capitol Hill, but those reservations are not great enough to actually get them to vote for America on a consistent basis.
Now, Congressman, let's turn to the Georgia voting law. I'm going to put up a petition at hughhewitt.com because I think the Georgia voting law is perfectly fine. I think it's a voting security law, and it's been libeled and slandered by America's media. And Major League Baseball moved the All-Star game. And that I'm a big baseball fan, but I am mad. I'm not buying a ticket this year. Has the blowback been sufficient to get them or Coca-Cola or Delta to reconsider?
I hope so. But what we as Americans have to understand is that the socialists have been very adept and very adroit at using their threatened boycotts and other extortionist means to cause businesses to side with socialist policies, even when the business owners abhor what they're doing. But they're afraid of losing the business and losing their ability to survive in a tough marketplace, losing their profits, and suddenly engaging in losses. And what we on the conservative side have to do, if you believe in your country, if you believe in the United States of America, if you see this onslaught against our values, then we have to counterbalance what the socialists are doing by organizing boycotts against the businesses that don't have the spine to do what's in the best interest of our country. So we have to do everything we can to make sure those businesses stay neutral. And I should add that the boards of directors of those businesses, the officers of those businesses that are engaging in this kind of political conduct, they have serious liability risk to the shareholders because the officers of those corporations and the board of directors of those corporations, they have a fiduciary duty to their shareholders to maximize profit. And when they engage in these political activities, they are shirking their fiduciary duty to those shareholders. And if I'm a shareholder of a company that starts losing money because of these companies dipping their toes into political matters that really aren't their primary reason for existence, then I start suing those board of director members and those officers who have caused those financial losses. And so I hope that any shareholder that is listening to my voice, if you see your company start to lose money because of the political activity of the company that you own shares in, well, then you need to hold your board of director members and you need to hold your officers of that corporation accountable. And if I could, Hugh, just 1 second, I know we're about to run out of time. If you want to help me win the Senate race, put a strong conservative voice, a principal conservative in the United States Senate, go to mobrooks.com. Really easy to remember, mobrooks.com. I need your help.
Now, I'll consider doing that, Congressman, and telling it over and over again. If I can get an admission from you that the SEC is a cartel that ought to be broken up, and they own the referees, and that's why Ohio State doesn't get past them. Can we get that admission from you?
I'm afraid, Hugh, you can't, but you might could from the in-law side of the family because my father-in-law is an Ohio State graduate. My wife went to a whole lot of Ohio State games because my parents-in-law had season tickets for decades.
There's so hope for you.
With Ohio State, but look, we're just better. This is free enterprise competition.
Oh.
We're just better.
and you're a Duke guy, too, aren't you?
Well, we don't want to bring that up.
I was going to say, I was looking for him in the bracket this year, and I didn't find the Blue Devils anywhere.
Oh,
so
you're hitting me hard. Yes, unfortunately, the Duke Blue Devils did not do that well. COVID-19 and a lot of other factors. The team just didn't mesh. These one-and-dones, I love the days when Coach K would go with people who actually went to college to get a degree. But that day is long gone with this one-and-done system. Duke, Kentucky, traditionally we have some of the best semi-pro teams in the NCAA tournament.
You're absolutely right on that. Congressman Mo Brooks, thank you. MoBrooks.com, MoBrooks.com. I appreciate it, Congressman. Don't go anywhere, America. Come right back here. I want to play for you one more time. If you just tuned in, Peter Thiel at the Nixon Library on Tuesday night on Bitcoin, cut number 17.
From China's point of view, they want to get... they don't like the U.S. having this reserve currency because it gives us, you know, a lot of leverage over, you know, Iranian oil supply chains and all sorts of things like that. They don't want the renminbi to become a reserve currency because then you have to open your capital account and you have to do all sorts of things that they really don't want to do. You know, I think the euro you could think of as, you know, was in part a Chinese weapon against the dollar. It didn't, in the last decade, it hasn't quite worked out that way, but that was. You know, China would have liked to see two reserve currencies like the euro. And, you know, even though I'm sort of a pro-crypto, pro-Bitcoin maximalist person, I do wonder whether at this point Bitcoin is also should also be thought in part of as a Chinese financial weapon against the U.S., where it's...
He's absolutely right. Money, and we're going to post some of the highlight reels at HughHewitt.com and the Peter Thiel conversation at thenixonseminar.com. Head over to HughHewitt.com. Be sure to sign the petition supporting the Georgia Voter Integrity Act. Welcome back, America. It's Hugh Hewitt. It's been Senate Day on the Hugh Hewitt Show. Talking to Steve Stiver, who's running in Ohio, Mo Brooks, who's running in Alabama. I talked to Kansas City Mayor Quentin Lucas last hour. He's going to be the best Democrat in Missouri. And now I'm talking to Attorney General Eric Schmidt of Missouri. General Schmidt is also running for the United States Senate. Welcome, General. Good to have you on.
It's great to be with you, Hugh.
I'm alarmed. Kansas City Mayor Q is a pretty formidable candidate on the air.
Well, we intend to keep this seat in safe Republican hands. That's my view. And I think as you look around the country right now, it feels as though our culture and country is sort of slipping away. And so my belief is that we need some fighters in Washington, D.C. That's been my record as Attorney General fighting alongside President Trump and the agenda that brought unprecedented growth. You know, energy independence and a secure border. And then on the front lines right now, taking a blowtorch to this Biden agenda that's really radical, and they're only about 75 days in, undermining a lot of that progress that was made. And so we need reinforcements. And I really believe that's the time to save America. So, look, in a more philosophical sense, Hugh, I love this republic. I love this country. I believe in American exceptionalism. I think the founders got it right when they said everybody else had it wrong before, that our rights come from God and government's just our shared project to protect those rights. And we need people willing to stand up for that. And so that's why I'm running for the Senate.
Now, Eric Schmidt, General, I don't get involved in primaries and endorsing, but I do keep a wary eye. I've had Eric Greitens on the show. I don't think he's coming back. He didn't like my questions. I think he will lose that seat. I don't know if Jason Smith or you could lose that seat, but I think Eric Greitens can lose that seat. Do you agree with me?
Well, here's what I know. These races are a lot closer than people think in a state like Missouri. So Donald Trump won Missouri by 20 points and 16 and about 15 or 16 points this past year. I won, for example, by 22 points this last November. These Senate races are much closer than that. In that same sort of time period, Roy Blunt won by 3 points and Josh Hawley won by 6 points because there's obviously a national focus. So we definitely need somebody who can hold this seat. And so I feel like I'm the best person to do that.
And now tell me, how are you going to differentiate yourself from the other candidate? Eric Greitens is running as a wronged incumbent who was hounded out of office, and people can make up their minds about that. Jason Smith is running as President Trump's favorite guy. What is Eric Schmidt running as?
Well, look, I think talk is cheap, right? You look at somebody's record. And so we're really leading the country right now. Missouri is taking the lead, as I mentioned earlier, and taking on this really radical agenda. So, for example, you know, on the first day of office, Joe Biden issues this executive order that deals with the Keystone XL pipeline. We're involved in that lawsuit to challenge that. He also created a working group, as he called it, with unelected cabinet members to decide what is the quote-unquote social cost of greenhouse gases. And so it's more like Nostradamus than it is Newton, right? They're predicting warfare and migration patterns and all these things hundreds of years in the future, pulling all of that back and then giving a blank check to the EPA and transportation, all these agencies to overtax and overregulate every aspect of our lives, making things more expensive, like cars and microwaves. We're on the front lines fighting that. So if you look and see what the AGs are doing across the country to really push back, Missouri's in the lead on that. So if you look at the record, a lifelong conservative who's never going to quit on this state, that's Eric Schmidt.
Now, I've sat down with David Yost, and we've talked about a number of the things he's brought to defend religious liberty. I know you're doing the same thing. What about big tech? Your predecessor, Josh Hawley, was going after big tech. He's continuing to do that in the Senate of the United States. I hope you've continued the investigation into Google.
Absolutely. So we're actually one of the states that were part of the William Barr Justice Department's antitrust suit. There were a handful of us that joined that antitrust suit against Google. We led the investigation into Facebook. Have also filed a lawsuit against Facebook for their anti-competitive behavior. I think this is an emerging – well, it's not emerging. It's here. It's right in front of us. I mean, you saw last night Google/YouTube TV cancels, deletes this roundtable Governor DeSantis was having on how lockdowns don't work. And so it's – I mean, they've taken an oversized part of our lives. They're restricting the amount of acceptable speech, narrowing that bandwidth of acceptable speech. And we've been very, very aggressive. So, yeah, that's part and parcel of what we're doing in our office. We're also, I was the first attorney general in the country to bring a lawsuit against Communist China for their role in the coronavirus. It's unmistakable what their role was in hiding this. I mean, they knew about human-to-human transmission as early as November, early December, didn't tell the world until January 21st, and we're all still dealing with it. So, you know, I'm somebody that's not afraid of that fight. And I believe in the law, and I believe in the Constitution, and I think that's, again, we need those kinds of folks standing up strong in the United States Senate.
Now, I don't want to geek out too much in our last minute, Attorney General Schmidt, and I hope you keep coming back. But Clarence Thomas dropped a bombshell whimsically sort of this week, saying maybe the market power of these big tech companies are so large that they fall under government action. What do you think about that?
So it's interesting. And actually, by the way, as a fun fact to you, not to geek out on you, Clarence Thomas got his start in the Missouri Attorney General's office under Jack Danforth in the 70s. And so we're
very I did know that. Yep.
So, well, and Jim Talent, I'm sure, you know, was a sort of a mentor to me over the years. I'm sure he's probably told a lot of people that, too. But no, it's he brought up what's a very interesting legal theory that's been bandied about in legal circles, which is the common carrier, right? You sort of can liken it to the railroads and the trusts. So people can say, like, for example, when they say when Twitter, you know, got rid of the president on their platform, we'll go get another platform. Well, you saw what happened. Parler then tries to start another platform, and they're banished. So
it is ripe for you to keep on the crusade, keep coming back and telling us about it, Attorney General Eric Schmidt. And America, come back tomorrow for the next Hugh Hewitt Show.